good to be back with you, to share the Sabbath with you. 25 years ago, I began attending the Worldwide Church of God, known then as Radio Church of God. In fact, 25 years ago last month. And my first Sabbath service was on the first Sabbath of February. And I came at a time when there was the build-up towards the Days of Unleavened Bread and the Passover season, of which I knew virtually little or nothing. But in the process of listening to the sermons and listening to the sermonettes and getting ready for this festival season, this spring festival, I found that I was not prepared. I had little knowledge and little understanding, to say the least, about it. But I found as the years have gone by, I have come to understand some of the passages that we are prone to read at this time of the year. And I wanted to share some of my progressive learning with you today, and especially over one point that many of us will read and contemplate and consider, but I don't know to what degree or how much knowledge and understanding you will have about it. If you'll turn with me to 1 Corinthians, the 11th chapter, a statement is made there. In fact, it's more than a statement. It is an insistence by the Apostle Paul that we do a certain thing, and he tells it in the context of the season we are about to enter. It says in 1 Corinthians 11 and verse 28, "But let a person examine himself or themselves, and so let him eat of that bread and drink of that cup." Examination. Let a person examine themselves. Now, this particular translation is good, but I found another one that I think is a bit more piquant that I'll share with you today out of the Jewish New Testament. This has been translated by some Messianic Jews who have embraced the Jesus Christ as their Savior, and David Stern is the individual who has put a lot of work into this particular translation. And the letters are a little bit smaller, so I have to let my eyes adjust just for a moment here to find it. Okay, here is the reading in this translation. "So let a person examine himself first, and then he may eat of the bread and drink from the cup." In other words, there is an examination that we must go through before we eat of the bread and drink of the wine. It is not a possibility. It is not if you feel like it. It is a must. It is a clear must that we examine ourselves. But there's a caution. I think Paul was indicating far more than simply a self-examination, because anyone knows that a doctor who has himself for a patient has a fool for a patient. Doctors have doctors. Lawyers have lawyers. All the professional people go and counsel with those who are expert in the field, so that in case they miss something, they'll have another eye, another set of eyes, another set of ears, someone that they can rely on, that they can count on to be thorough. In the case of this examination that we are to embark upon, we should get help. But let's look again at a letter that Paul wrote to the Corinthians. It's called 2 Corinthians. Chapter 13, another statement is made here in the light of what we should do in examining ourselves. 2 Corinthians 13 and verse 5, it says, "Examine yourselves whether you be in the faith. Prove your own selves. Don't you know? Know you not your own selves how that Jesus Christ is in you, except you be a reprobate or a castaway or someone who is worthless or devoid of judgment?" So it is important that we do go through this process. And as we embark upon this season, let us examine ourselves. But let us submit to the examination that counts. And in this case, we talk today about the examination of God. The examination of God. Now, why is it that I indicate to you today that your simple self-examination in the case, may I be frank, of a woman giving herself a self-exam dealing with a breast cancer possibility? You would want confirmation. You would want to go to someone who is a more expert in considering the possibility that there might be something cancerous. You wouldn't simply go on your own knowledge. Even though your knowledge may be good, it may not be adequate. Let's look at Jeremiah 17 for a moment to understand why I caution you in assuming that the self-examinations we have gone through in prior years may not be sufficient. Because there is a danger in simply leaning to our own understanding. The scriptures tell us to lean not to your own understanding. Don't trust in your ways and your thoughts completely. It says here in chapter 17 of Jeremiah, we'll begin in verse 5. Thus says the Eternal, cursed be the man that trusts in man and makes flesh his arm and whose heart departs from the Lord. In other words, he's beginning to set the pattern here. Even if we put ourselves in the case of the man and the flesh, to trust in yourself alone is foolhardy. It's dangerous. It says, for he shall be like the heat in the desert, and shall not see when good comes, but shall inhabit the parched places in the wilderness, in a salt land, and not inhabit it. But blessed is the man that trusts in the Lord, whose hope the Eternal is. For he shall be as a tree planted by the waters, and that spreads out his roots by the river, and shall not see when heat comes, but her leaf shall be green, and shall not be careful in the year of drought, neither shall cease from yielding fruit. And then this prophet says, the heart is deceitful above all things, and desperately wicked. Who can know it? So in the process of going through this self-examination, who can know it? Who can know you completely and surely? Self-examination, is that sufficient? Is that adequate? Do you want to trust in that alone? It goes on to say, I, the ever-living one, search the heart. I try the reins, even to give every man according to his ways and according to the fruit of his doings. So God, then, is key to our examination. He is central to understanding something about ourselves. He tries. He examines. He tests. That is the best source. And today we will look at the examination of God. Now, David knew the secret. He knew the secret to examining oneself. And over in Psalm 26, we find him making a statement that we should examine ourselves. Psalm 26 and verse 2. This is a psalm of David, and he says in verse 1, judge me, O Lord, for I have walked in mine integrity. I have trusted also in the Eternal, therefore I shall not slide. And then verse 2, examine me, O Lord, and prove me. Try my reins and my heart. We just read in Jeremiah, did we not? About, I search the heart. I try the reins. I test. This is the great physician. This is the master examiner that we're talking about here. And David knew the secret. He understood it. And he submitted himself to this examination. Paul's instruction about examining ourselves can be grossly misunderstood unless the perfect perception is obtained. Now again, in Psalm 139, we find another statement in this light, Psalm 139 and verse 23. 139, verse 23. And this is also a Psalm of David. He says, search me, O Lord, and know my heart.
try me and know my thoughts. So in the process of our preparing for the Passover season, a time of examination, we must not neglect to utilize all of the power resource available to us. And simply going through and reading some scriptures and having some thoughts, but not doing a thorough examination might leave some leaven in place. Another word for exam is to try, to test. God examined ancient Israel. He examined them in many ways. Here are a few. He examined them by contrasting them to the Egyptians. God examined ancient Israel by doing mighty miracles. He also examined them by showing his faithfulness to his promises. And he examined them by bringing out a despised, tattered people and making them a nation. You say, God examined Israel? Oh, yes. It was an examination in process. All the history we have concerning those ancient people, we find God seeking to know something. So he put them to the test. He examined them. He tried them. And then, at some juncture in history, he said, "Oh, that there were a heart in them, that they would trust me, that they would fear me, and keep my commandments," because he found out something about that ancient people. He tried them by revealing himself to a people who did not remember or know who he was. In the course of our lives, we all forget. We all need reminders. Hence, we have the Sabbath. We have the holy days as reminders, as memorials, as waymarks by which we can readjust our path as we go through life. We too, like them, need tools for examination, for the examination of God is most revealing. In God's examination of the children and the slaves of Israel, what did he see? Let's turn over to Exodus, the first chapter. What did he see when he went through this examination process? You know the story. I won't read all of these passages here, but we have a people. A people who originally came to the land, 70 or so in number, and they were very popular because Joseph, their brother, was held in high regard and high esteem in the nation. He was second in command to the Pharaoh. And so when they pilgrimed to and sojourned in the land, they received accommodations. They received acceptance. They eventually grew to such size that the Pharaoh gave them a land, Goshen. And they lived there satisfied with plenty. In times of famine, they had plenty. They were blessed. But that was not the promise that God had given them. The land that he had promised them was off in another place. In fact, it was where there had been a famine. But they had become very satisfied with their location. And in the process of 400 years, that's a lot of time, they multiplied and grew. They fashioned themselves into a people. And along comes a Pharaoh who knew not Joseph, who had, not that he didn't have access to history to know that Joseph had existed and all of the conditions prior to the 400 years, but to not know it means simply to ignore, to disregard. And so this Pharaoh looked over at this land of Goshen with these teeming masses of people and said, "Well, you know, if we were attacked by an outside party, these people, these Israelites, could join in league with them and we would have a formidable foe to deal with. I must do something about that. And so I'm going to enslave these people and I'm going to put a great burden on them. I'm going to work them 7 days a week. And in fact, I'm going to devise a plan that if they continue to be so populous, I'm going to have all of their male children killed." And in fact, he did all of that. What did God see when he began the examination of Israel? he saw people who were rejected, people who were disoriented, confused, forgotten, distressed, despised, afflicted, and discouraged. Have you ever had any of those feelings? I would say every one of us has had one or more of those feelings at one time or another. And what did God do about it when he saw these people in the process of his examination? And what will he do for you? Let's look closely. Exodus, the first chapter, verse 8. We have here a statement. Now there arose a new king over Egypt, which knew not Joseph. And he said unto his people, Behold, the people of the children of Israel are more and mightier than we. Come on, let us deal wisely with them. Let's use some wisdom now, lest they multiply. And it came to pass that when they fall out any war, they join also with our enemies and fight against us, and so let them up out of the land. Therefore, and see, they didn't want to lose the land. The economy would kind of plummet if you let these people go. They were working well, and it seems like Egypt was being blessed by having them around. Verse 11, therefore they did set over them taskmasters to afflict them with their burdens. And they built for Pharaoh treasure cities, Pithom and Ramses. But the more they afflicted them, the more they multiplied and grew. And they were grieved because of the children of Israel. And the Egyptians made the children of Israel to serve with rigor. And they made their lives bitter with hard bondage, in mortar and in brick, and in all manner of service in the field. All their service, wherein they made them serve, was with rigor. These people were in it. And God looked and examined them. God saw that they were who they really were, and he knew who they really were. Let's read over in the second chapter now, verse 23. And it came to pass in the process of time that the king of Egypt died, and the children of Israel sighed by reason of the bondage. And they cried, and their cry came up unto God by reason of their bondage. And God heard their groaning. And God remembered his covenant with Abraham, with Isaac, and with Jacob. And God looked upon the children of Israel, and God had respect or knowledge. He gave attention unto them. God was concerned for them in their misery and in their shame. When he began his examination process, he saw a people who were least. He was later to tell them, I didn't choose you because you were the greatest or the mighty. I chose you because you were the least of all nations. This examination process of God can be very difficult because he sees us not as we see ourselves. Perhaps at some point in time, Israel, as they often did, thought of themselves as somebody great, somebody significant. We're the chosen people, you know. And God had a way. He has a way of bringing you down and establishing just who you really are. Exodus 3, chapter 3, and verse 7, continuing. And the Eternal said, I have surely seen the affliction of my people which are in Egypt, and have heard their cry by reason of their taskmasters, for I know their sorrows, and I am come down to deliver them out of the hand of the Egyptians, and to bring them out of that land unto a good land, and a large land, unto a land flowing with milk and honey, unto a place of the Canaanites, and the Hittites, and the Amorites, the Perizzites, and the Hivites, and the Jebusites. Now, therefore, behold, the cry of the children of Israel is come up unto me. I have also seen the oppression wherewith the Egyptians oppressed them. Come now, therefore, and I will send you, Moses, unto Pharaoh, that you may bring my people, the children of Israel, out of Egypt. We've all learned over the years that Egypt has been synonymous with sin. The parallel is clear. In the process of God examining ancient Israel, he learned that they needed to be brought out of where they were. Now, there were some in this crowd who felt things were okay. You said, well, how could a slave think everything is okay? Well, pretty easy process if that's all you know. If that's all that you have, and especially we learn later on after they get out into the wilderness, and things get a little hot, the Pharaoh is coming up from behind, and the mountains are on either side, and the Red Sea looms large before them, they said, oh, if we just could have stayed where we were, by the flesh pots of Egypt, in sin, we would have been all right. The examination of God brings out some peculiar things in us, some peculiar responses, because it is a pressure cooker to determine just what we are and how we think. Israel had become comfortable with their surroundings, sort of like a welfare recipient. You know, third, second generation, satisfied. This is okay. This is not so bad. But they will moan and groan. You know, we need some more money. We need this. We need this program. We need that. We'll moan and groan about it, but we're actually afraid to break away from the practice. Israel was afraid to break away. So many of them didn't even know who God was, because his knowledge, the awareness of him was not central to their daily lives. As a result of not observing the Sabbath, every Sabbath rolls around, they were working. They couldn't turn to the creation to understand and to draw closer to God because of the inclement nature surrounding them with the Egyptians holding sway over them. Complacency had set in, and the question today is, can it set in with us? Can we be like the ancient Israelites? Israel had forgotten their covenant handed down from their father to the son, from Abraham to Isaac and to Jacob. They had forgotten it. They had kept up the token of the covenant, circumcision, for sure. They had to have done that, we understand from the 12th chapter, because in order to partake of the Passover, they had to have been circumcised. So they had that going for them. But essentially they had forgotten. They had forgotten that God had given them a land. They were satisfied with Goshen. But God had given them Palestine. They had forgotten that. What about us? We also have a land promised to us. Some people figuratively call it over there, you know, across the Jordan, campground, you know, in the sweet by and by. A lot of names have been given to this land, glory land. It's a land. A fateless day lies a city four square. It shall never pass away, called a city four square. God shall wipe away all tears. There'll be no death, no pain, no fears. And we count not time by years in a city four square. We have a land too. We have a land, and we must go to that land. We must not be like the Israelites who were satisfied with Goshen. We've been promised a land. They were also given a token of the covenant. It was called circumcision. We too have a token of the covenant, and it too is circumcision, but it is the circumcision of the heart. We must submit to that operation. Abraham was their father. So is he to us. They became inactive in claiming their covenant. What about us? Well, so can we. What does God see when he examines us? We have looked a little bit at what he saw when he saw the children of Israel. And he must have shaken his head many times and said, well, if it weren't for Abraham and my promise to him, if it wasn't for Isaac and it wasn't for Jacob, remember how he responded when he got the children out there. And he told Moses, step aside so that I can destroy every one of them in the wilderness. And Moses reminded him, well, don't do that, because people will say You were unable to carry them into the land if you were to destroy them all. In God's examination of that ancient people, he found things despicable. He found things unpleasant. He found a lot of leaven lurking about. In their examination process, they refused to see certain things, to comprehend what it was God was doing with them. What about us? What does God see when he examines us? Does he see us covered with the blood? Does he see us covered with the blood of Christ, or have we strayed from underneath that precious covering? We go back to Exodus 12, and we understand why God set up this Passover feast, and especially on the occasion that he instituted it here in the 12th chapter of Exodus. He has seen the people. He has heard their cry. He has seen their affliction, and he's determined to move upon the promises given to their ancient fathers. And he tells them, after they have experienced like plagues that had fallen upon the rest of Egypt, the Nile River turned to blood. Where did they get their water? The Nile River. The flies, the frogs, the lice, they were aware of all of that. They were in the presence of all of that. But now God was going to do a thing whereby they were going to be spared. And he gives them the scenario of what he wanted them to do. You know the story. You will be reading these passages, and probably have already, concerning the Passover. He tells them, I want you to take a lamb, and set it up from the 10th day of the month to the 14th day, and I want you to kill it at a certain time. And then I want you to take the blood, and I want you to put it on the doorposts and the lintels of the house. Because when the death angel passes over, I'm going to slay every firstborn in the land. That's what I'm going to do. But I will pass over where I see the blood. In this examination process, God gave them an inoculation. He gave them the ability to be preserved, to be untouched by the plague to ascend upon the land or descend upon the land. Marvelous imagery when we honestly and sincerely sit down and think about it. Exodus 12, brethren, is an act of redemption, and it was needed. Old things, old ways, old attitudes, old affections had to pass away. They couldn't simply be comfortable any longer working in the slime pits, making brick, working 7 days a week in the old way, taking the hooks and throwing them into the flesh pots and seeing what luscious delectable was yanked out of there, something unclean perhaps. The old ways, the old attitudes, the old viewpoints had to pass away. They had, as it says in verse 31, to forsake Egypt. It says, and he called for Moses and Aaron. This is Pharaoh, after the event of the death angel passing through the land. He called for Moses and Aaron by night and said, rise up and get you forth from among the people, both you and the children of Israel, and go serve the Eternal, as you have said. Moses had made the case. Aaron had made the case. God wanted his people to go forth and serve him. Now Pharaoh acquiesced to the wish and the plan. And they were permitted to go forth out of this type of sin into an area where they could worship successfully their God. The examination of God will extricate us from what it is that weighs us down, whatever it may be that troubles us, whatever impediment to clear and conscientious and dedicated worship of God, he can strip away. He did it with the ancient children of Israel. He can do it with us. Now, 1 Peter 4 and verse 12 says something in the light of this examination process that we talk about. 1 Peter, the fourth chapter. And it's important to know and comprehend why we look at ancient Israel. Because we understand from the New Testament there is something called spiritual Israel, and that we have to buy into that community and become a part of that great company that God is developing. 1 Peter 4 and verse 12. It says, beloved. I like that. Peter used that term. John used that term. Beloved. Perhaps for some of us it's difficult. I confess it's difficult to use those types of terms of endearment. Beloved, lovey, dovey, you know, sweetie pie, cutie, and, you know, that kind of thing. Here the apostle found no problem in talking to the children of God and calling them beloved. Think it not strange concerning the fiery trial which is to try you. Remember what we said earlier. Examination is like a trial. It's a test. You are being tried. Don't think it strange if you should have to endure it, as though some strange thing happened unto you. Notice verse 13. But rejoice, inasmuch as you are partakers of Christ's suffering, that when his glory shall be revealed, you may be glad also with exceeding joy. Do not think it strange as we move into the Passover season. The things begin to happen. Inexplicable things. Sicknesses arise. Financial difficulties. Unemployment springs up. Accidents occur. Why would it be strange? Why would it be different than even ancient Israel experienced? It is important for us to understand that to become an Israelite spiritually will expose us to this examination process. God's examination, brethren, is severe. How many of us hurry up to get to the doctor? Oh, I don't know if I want to go to the doctor because, I mean, first I got to sit and wait in the waiting room, you know, and then I got to go sit in the examination room, and then he's going to come in and it's going to be too much money. And I just don't like his bedside manner either, or her. You know what I mean? We all kind of avoid it, going to the doctor, and especially to the dentist. You don't want to submit to the examination because it can be painful. God's examination is severe. Notice 1 Corinthians 3. There is no middle ground, no ifs, ands, and buts about it. We have to submit to this godly examination. If our examination is going to be validated, if what we see in ourselves is to be established as true, if we are to correct our course and move into a more spiritual realm, 1 Corinthians 13 and 3 and verse 13, it says, every man's work shall be made manifest, for the day shall declare it, because it shall be revealed by fire, and the fire shall try, shall examine, shall test every man's work of what sort it is. That's the examination of God. Leaves no stone unturned, needs no closet to hide in. It is sure. Back in 1 Peter again, where Peter makes a great statement in his opening letter, 1 Peter 1 and verse 7. Familiar scriptures all, but in the light of this examination we are supposed to be doing at this time of the year, let us consider them in that context. That the trial of your faith, being much more precious than of gold that perishes, though it be tried, though it be examined, though it be tested with fire, might be found unto praise and honor and glory at the appearing of Jesus Christ. It's a necessary process. You cannot not be examined. Whom having not seen, you love. In whom, though now you see him not, yet believing, you rejoice with joy unspeakable and full of glory. That's the examination, receiving the end of your faith, even the salvation of your souls. That's the end result of submission to this examination of God. Salvation. The salvation that will allow us to claim those precious promises, to actually be in the land, to actually sit down with our father Abraham. Those are the promises, but only if you're examined. He found something worthy in Israel to save. He did. After all that they did, year after year, he still finds something worth saving. What about us? We have exceedingly greater promises. What was it that he saw that made them worthy of saving? Was it the blood? We know in the first Passover, that's what it was. It wasn't because they were righteous. It wasn't because they were full of the knowledge of God. It wasn't because they were worshipful before God. The only thing that made the difference was the blood on the door. What about the blood that covers us? Was it the promise then to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob? Was that the difference? Well, if you say, yeah, that's what it was, I tell you, the blood was part of it. The blood was tied into the promises to Abraham and to Isaac and to Jacob, and therefore the promises included the blood. Notice in Galatians, the third chapter, this astonishing statement made by the apostle to a people who were inundated by false teachers who wanted them to do something different than what had been given to them by this apostle, this one who served to convert them to the truth. He says in the third chapter in verse 8, "And the Scripture, foreseeing that God would justify the heathen or the nations or the goyim or the Gentiles through faith, preached before the gospel unto Abraham." What? You use a New Testament phrase to talk about an Old Testament circumstance, and you say the gospel was preached to Abraham? Well, that's what Paul says. The good news was spoken to Abraham, saying, and this was the good news to him, "In you shall all nations be blessed." And that's quoted right out of Genesis 12 and verse 3. The very first time of the recorded introduction of himself to Abraham, or Abram, God gives that promise to him. "In you shall all the nations be blessed." And everyone knows and agrees that this was a prophetic statement about Jesus Christ. The promise that all the nations of the world would be blessed as a result of the seed that would come through Abraham. It says then, "So then, they which be of faith are blessed with faithful Abraham." Spiritual Israel? You bet. A necessity? Absolutely. To tie into that community and attach ourselves to the awesome promises given to Abraham and to Isaac and to Jacob. Verse 29 it says, "And if you be Christ's, then are you Abraham's seed. In you shall all the nations of the world be blessed." And if you be Christ, if you belong to Christ, if you submit to Christ, you are Abraham's seed and heirs according to the promises. Different promises? Separate promises other than the promises given to Abraham? The same promises. It is a marvelous thing to contemplate that when we submit ourselves to the examination of God, he does not have to say of us, "Oh, that there were such a heart in them that they would fear me and keep my commandments." No. There will be rejoicing with the fact that we will submit to it. Let's turn now to 1 Corinthians 10. This is the famous chapter of Paul writing to the Corinthian church, composed of Gentiles and Jews, and he tells them a startling thing concerning the ancient events. If we wonder and pause, "Well, now, Israel, that's fine, the story is nice, and the Passover is nice, and it made a nice movie, you know, Ten Commandments, and but what does that have to do with us today as we go through our New Testament existence?" Paul gives this answer. Verse 1, "Moreover, brethren, I would not that you should be ignorant." Strong word, isn't it? About why it is we attach ourselves and submit ourselves to an examination as those ancient people did. "I don't want you to be ignorant," he says, "how that all our fathers were under the cloud and all passed through the sea." He's right, he's talking to Gentiles too. And he says, our fathers. Just like he said in Galatians concerning Abraham, and if you're Christ's seed, then are you Abraham's seed as well, if you belong to Christ? All were baptized unto Moses in the cloud and in the sea. And did all eat the same spiritual meat? And did all drink the same spiritual drink? For they drank of that spiritual rock, that rock of ages that we talk about, that followed them. And that rock was Christ. A powerful statement that no one who wants to wrestle with the New Testament can do any justice to say that Christ did not exist prior to his coming and his birth with Mary. No way. "But with many of them, God was not well pleased." Oh, in this examination he submitted them to, he wasn't pleased with the results. "For they were overthrown in the wilderness." Wilderness being a type of sin. "Now these things were our examples, to the intent we should not lust after evil things, as they also lusted. Neither be you idolaters, as were some of them. As it is written, the people sat down to eat and drink and rose up to play. Neither let us commit fornication, as some of them committed, and fell in one day 23,000. Neither let us tempt Christ, as some of them also tempted and were destroyed of serpents." Don't let us do that. "Neither murmur you, as some of them also murmured and were destroyed by the destroyer." Now all these things, Paul says, happen unto them for ensamples, for types, for examples. And they are written for our admonition, upon whom the ends of the world are come. It's one thing to cast aspersions and do the, boy, those Israelites, I tell you, look what they did. Look how they murmured. Look how they complained. Look how they moaned and groaned. Look how they were unwilling to cooperate. Look how they felt that they were so special. And look. And not apply the same yardstick to ourselves, to see how sometimes we respond as they did, to see that sometimes we fall short like they did, and to see sometimes, in spite of their unworthiness, God gave them a plan by which they could come under the blood's covering for a night. That was temporary. It was ephemeral. It went away. It was not lasting. But the sacrifice of Jesus Christ, one that we examine, one that we look at and look to, is permanent. It's eternal. It never has to be done again. And we must come under that blood covering. Paul locks it down very clearly to us in verse 12, and he casts it in concrete by saying, "Wherefore, let him that thinks he stands take heed lest he fall." And the same book was where he said, "Examine yourselves." He gave plenty of evidence that that examination should have an ally. It should have an agent. It should have a tool by which that examination is thorough. The best equipped physicians are able to give a thorough examination because they have the equipment to do a probing analysis of the situation. We can think that we know, but we are not always sure. We are not always clear. My encouragement to you today is to submit yourselves as the Passover season comes to us. Submit yourselves to the examination of God. After all, it's the only examination that counts.